This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
It's a Friday jobs day, so there is that. Global economies numbers 1 and 2 had a little chat this week. We can add that to the list. And while you're at it, try to figure out what Janet Yellen is thinking for me, would you? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosdahl. Friday, the 7th of April. Good as always to have you along, everybody. It has been a mostly foreign policy week, yes, but the global economy takes a backseat to nobody. Least of all, Sudeep Reddy. He's at Politico. Lynette Lopez, she is at Business Insider. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So let's, I guess we start with jobs, right, Lynette? And I don't want to talk about the specifics because, honestly, they're chewed over by now. 98,000 new jobs, 4.5% on the rate. What I want to know is this. Given where we are in this cycle, with the economy approaching or at full employment and things humming along, if not as well as we want, is jobs what we ought to be looking at when we try to figure out what's up with this economy?
Well, there's a lot to be said for continuing to make sure that the economy is doing well. I always come on this program and talk about wage growth,
wage growth.
And so I still think that's the number to watch. And I think the other number to watch, if you care about what Janet Yellen has to say, is inflation, because it seems like not hitting that 2% inflation target is one of the only things that's been holding the Fed back from raising rates over the last couple of times they had the opportunity, though they did last time. So that's, I think, more important number to watch.
All right. So, Sudeep, inflation's off the table. Wages are off the table. Jobs are off the table. What do you want to look at?
That's what matters. That is all that matters.
What
people
else is
look
there?
At the, you know, the headline numbers. The headline numbers are headline numbers. They get a lot of attention, and pea brain politicians love to talk about them.
Oh,
but
snap.
What people love to
tough.
Feel... It's wage growth. That's what people care about. They care about their wage growth. They care about what they're paying for at the grocery store and everywhere else. And inflation is relatively modest. Wages are increasing, just not increasing fast enough. And so that's a good environment. Janet Yellen would take that. Donald Trump should want that. Most members of Congress who are in charge should want it. It just doesn't have the same flash as everything else that we've been seeing with much larger headline numbers.
Well, since you mentioned politicians, let me turn, Lynette, to you and ask, you know, there was a period like 3 years ago where every time Congress and the White House got involved in the economy, it just came to a screeching halt. Now, Congress and the White House can't sort of do anything. Are we better off for that?
You know, I don't know. I think that's a very political question. What I do know is that there is a divergence in data coming out. The soft data, i.e. how everyone feels about the economy, is coming in a lot hotter and stronger than the data that shows us that maybe we're going into a little bit of a slowdown. I mean, we've had a bull market and we've had an economy on the way to recovery for the last 8 years. So economists are starting to wonder, hey, are we starting to slow down? We're seeing auto sales slow down. We're seeing manufacturing numbers slow down. We're seeing all sorts of consumer services numbers slow down. So I think that's something that the Fed is watching. And I think that is something that politicians in Washington might pay attention to if they want to chew on something a little more meaty than the headline numbers.
Well, and we know what Sudeep thinks about politicians. Let me very quickly, Sudeep, ask you a question about the Fed. In the minutes from their last meeting that came out this week, in which they said, we're going to start unwinding our balance sheet. That is to say, sell off some of the assets they accumulated during the crisis. And everybody went, whoa, wait, what are you doing? Why do you think the Fed is doing that now?
Because it's been a decade since the early stages of the crisis began. If you had looked in the summer of 2007, when the early stages of the global credit crunch developed, you would have Almost nobody predicted that a decade later you'd still have all of these crisis interventions. You'd have interest rates around 1%. You'd have all of these really extreme interventions still embedded in our economy. They have to pull it back. They know they need to pull it back, and they're just at the beginning of talking about pulling. Well, they've been talking about it for a while, but
people thought we would have to pull it back.
Right. Yeah,
people thought we'd have to pull it back because they thought there was going to be massive inflation after the, you know, and that hasn't happened yet. The data isn't showing us that we're going to have some crazy inflationary cycle and that we need to pull these interest rates up. The argument mainly is like we need to pull them up because it's been so long. But with the hard data softening, the question is that enough of a reason? Or do we wait until, you know, we really see this hard data getting stronger, and do we wait until inflation actually hits a 2% target, which it still hasn't done?
And we're waiting, right? Exactly.
The Fed
right.
is very good at planning. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, Sudeep, let me take a really quick turn to foreign affairs. The meeting between President Trump and President Xi of China broke up this afternoon with neither a statement nor a presser, no nothing. They just basically said, "We'll see you later," and went on about their merry ways. In the 30 seconds that I'm going to squeeze out of the time we have left, which is not really 30 seconds. How much import do you put on the fact that this summit just kind of fizzled out?
It's all fun and games when you're not in charge
until
of the world's largest economy and the most powerful military. So that this is what President Trump is dealing with now. He could have a message about trade and about currency and about job loss. But when you're actually dealing superpower to superpower, you can't use the same kind of rhetoric. You can't play the same kind of games. You have to actually get down. And the fact that there wasn't a big blow up is probably a pretty good sign that this was engagement between two economies that is going to at least follow a pattern that we've established rather than surprise everyone and scare everyone.
All right, we got to go. That's Sudeep Reddy. I'm sorry, Lynette. We're live radio. What can I tell you? Lynette Lopez from Business Insider. Sudeep Reddy, he's at Politico. We'll talk next time, you guys. Bye-bye.
Thanks, bye, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street today, remarkably calm given, you know, everything. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The missile attacks last night in Syria prompted a strong reaction from Russia today. Moscow is one of Bashar al-Assad's few supporters, as you know, but other than their general dislike of the United States at the moment, there are other reasons that Russia is willing to go to the mat for Assad again and again. Marketplace's Kimberly Adams reports that you can, as usual, follow the money on this one.
There's a lot of money moving between Russia and Syria.
Most of this is reflected in large arms deals.
Emily Hawthorne is an analyst with the geopolitical intelligence platform Stratfor.com.
But there's also activity by Russian oil and gas firms. There's Russian investments and interest in agriculture in Syria. There's even information technology companies.
And there's also debt, lots of it. Hawthorne says while Iran is currently providing most of the cash, keeping Assad's regime afloat, Russia was an early backer. Anna Borshevskaya is a fellow at the Washington Institute for Near East Policy.
One of the things that happened, especially in the early years of the Syrian conflict, is Russia has provided loans to Assad, basically staving off Assad's bankruptcy.
She says Russian businesses have also invested billions in Syria.
Down the road, a loss of contracts is one of the many, many reasons that motivate Putin.
Russian President Vladimir Putin also has to keep in mind Syria has been, for decades, one of Russia's military anchors in the Middle East. And Syria has Russia's most significant military base outside the former Soviet Union. Plus, and this is pretty dark, wars are good for advertising. Weapons advertising.
Syria doesn't have a lot of money right now, but there are plenty of other countries that do and that are interested in alternatives to American supplies.
Dmitry Gorenberg is with CNA, a defense-oriented research institute. He says the Russians wouldn't have entered the conflict just to show off weapons.
But as long as they're there, they're certainly using the opportunity.
It's estimated almost 500,000 people have died so far as a result of the five-year conflict. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Okay, changing gears here. According to the Pew Research Center, more than 60% of American adults get at least some of their news on social media, platforms that, as we learned, during the election are susceptible to fake news. So Facebook announced fake news spotting tips for its users this week, and Google now has a tool available in languages used worldwide to help its users know if the news they are reading is real and, in fact, fact-checked. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains what that means when you Google something.
Google knows when people type in a search, the results could include fake news. Now you'll see a fact-check label next to questionable claims. Bill Adair is at Duke University's Reporters Lab. It helped build this feature for Google.
I think the benefit for anybody who does a Google search is they're going to see highlighted in their results if the statement has been fact-checked and whether it's true or not.
If you type in Barack Obama's birth certificate is fake, the results now include a line that says fact check, colon false, all caps, and cites Snopes as the fact checker. There's some nuance. The fact check might label a claim mostly true, for example. Adair says fact checking is a growing business.
When we started counting fact checking organizations back in 2013, there were probably 30 fact checking organizations around the world. Today, there are 115.
But that growth could bring problems, like a need to police whether fact-checkers are independent and unbiased. Filippo Menzer teaches computer science and studies social media at Indiana University.
It's always an arms race, and as soon as you create a rule or a norm or an algorithm to defend from some kind of abuse, then some other more clever form of abuse will start.
If Google, its parent company Alphabet, and Facebook are serious about combating fake news, they'll have to up their investment, too. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Congress is off for spring break as of today, which leaves, among other things, the Republican effort to replace the Affordable Care Act undone, despite some chatter late this week of more legislative tinkering that's going on in Washington. But politics aside, one of the things happening out in the actual healthcare economy right now is a continued increase in the number of rural hospitals that are shutting down. As WABE's LEU reports now from Southwest Georgia, when a small town loses its hospital, it loses more than just its healthcare provider.
Cindy Jones still can't help but think about the timing of things. Stuart Webster Hospital, the place her family had gone to for years, closed in March of 2013. A month later, her husband Bill suffered a heart attack.
He came in from a day of farming and ate supper and then sat down to watch David Letterman. And all of a sudden, he got quiet. And we knew something was wrong because he wasn't laughing at David Letterman anymore.
According to the county coroner, it took about 10 minutes for paramedics to arrive. Then it took almost a half hour to get to the town of Cuthbert, 25 miles away, where the nearest hospital is now. Jones's husband was pronounced dead in the ER 20 minutes after he arrived. Jones says she doesn't know if it would have made a difference had the local hospital still been open, but she can't help but wonder.
I feel like we lost time there if we had just, you know, gotten help 9 miles from my home.
Her husband, Bill, a peanut farmer, was 52 years old. That local hospital, Stuart Webster, had 25 beds and an emergency room. It's in the middle of a residential street in Richland, Georgia.
It's just devastating to see it in the shape it's in now.
I'm here with Sybil Ammons, the county coroner. She used to be the director of nursing at the hospital. Today, the white one-story building is locked up and surrounded by overgrowth. The building's paint is chipped.
Oh, it was clean and neat with flowers everywhere. My aunt had planted some daylilies. We took so much pride in this hospital. Everybody here did.
When it closed, Ammon says about 70 people lost their jobs. She says a small hospital still had an important role helping people injured in all kinds of emergencies, from car crashes to hunting accidents.
We saved a lot of lives. We did have to transfer them to a bigger hospital, but they were stabilized at Stuart Webster.
Stuart Webster is one of about 80 hospitals that have closed across the country since 2010. George Pink studies those closures at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He says in recent years, the rate of closures has gone up, and almost half of all rural hospitals are currently losing money.
I mean, there's just a lot of different things happening all at the same time, and this has put enormous financial pressures on rural hospitals.
Rural hospitals are still recovering from the recession, and Pink says
people who live in the South and in rural areas in the South are older, sicker, and poorer, have greater dependence on Medicare and Medicaid than people living in urban centers.
Meanwhile, back in Richland, Mayor Adolph McClendon says having a hospital in town is not just about health access, but also about the rural economy. He says since Stuart Webster Hospital closed, a lot of the shops on the city's main road have shuttered.
Broad Street was full of businesses, and it's not full of businesses now. We are trying to come back, but it's hard.
For coroner and former hospital nurse Sybil Ammons, attracting new businesses to Richland without a hospital is a tough sell.
Without health care, people don't want to stay here. I don't blame them.
The town is trying to get a 6-bed emergency treatment center right now, but the mayor says they're still just talking about it and haven't yet raised the money. In Stewart County, Georgia, I'm Ellie Yu for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I think a lot of people sort of enjoy vicariously that I'm cutting up this thing that they themselves worry about.
All in the name of art, of course. First, though, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial is basically flat today, down just 6 points, closed at 20,656. NASDAQ also flat, down a point, 58.77. The S&P 500 gave back less than a 10%, 1.2355. I should have just said flatty McFlat, flat, flat, right? The Dow Industrials this week, flat. NASDAQ down 0.5%. The S&P 500 off 0.3%. Crude closed at $52.24 a barrel. That is up 3% on the week after those missile strikes. Stocks and defense contractors gained at first and then leveled off. The maker of the Tomahawks used last night, Raytheon, saw its price rise 1.5% today. Bonds down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.38%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, it's Kai Rizdahl.
And I'm Molly Wood.
If you want to get smarter about the things we talk about on Marketplace every day,
technology, the economy, culture, check out our weekly podcast, Make Me Smart. It's a chance to tell us the things you really want to learn more about and share with us the things you know more about than anyone else.
We're at marketplace.org/makemesmart or wherever you get your podcasts, and follow us on Twitter for updates. I'm at Kai Rizdahl. Molly is at Molly Wood. Check it out.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Gusto. Let your employees know you've got their back by signing up for Gusto for payroll and HR. More than 300,000 small business owners use Gusto. They offer benefits like health insurance, employee onboarding, and more. Get your payroll taxes filed, deductions calculated, and your team paid fast. No more pain. Just the joy of running your business. Get 3 months free when you go to gusto.com/marketplace. That's gusto.com/marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Nashville, Tennessee, like a lot of other cities and a lot of the rest of the country, is changing. And I mean literally changing here. There is a development boom going on in Nashville. So who lives where is in some flux. To put it a bit more plainly, middle-class whites are moving into neighborhoods that for the better part of a century have been communities of color. And some of the churches rooted in those neighborhoods are being pushed out. From WPLN in Nashville, Mariba Knight has the story of two churches weighing the pros and cons of leaving.
Morris Tipton is the pastor at First Baptist Church of East Nashville.
How you doing?
Take care.
As he greets his members on a recent Sunday, he shakes every hand and gives big bear hugs. It's a small congregation, maybe 100 people. The church has been here for 90 years in this red brick, classical, revival-style building.
Not much has changed with this sanctuary, probably as long as I've been living. I'm 52.
But outside, the neighborhood has transformed. Luxury apartments sprouted up next door, a fancy hot yoga studio opened down the street. Young professionals are moving in as land prices soar. And in turn, some black churches are leaving, selling their buildings to developers and following their congregants out to the edges of town and beyond. Though it could sell for anywhere from $2 to $3 million, Tipton says the church will stay put, and he's been approached to sell.
I told the realtor, I don't even want to know what you're willing to offer because I believe God has us here.
Father God, right now in the name of Jesus, that name that is...
2 miles away is Pastor Glenda Sutton. She's led Family Affair Ministries since the mid-90s when she started preaching from her apartment at a Nashville housing project. When she bought this church in 2001, the neighborhood was rough.
People didn't talk to each other. It was just a lot of violence. It was a lot of anger. It was a very, very dark place.
In fact, it had a nickname.
Little Hellhole.
But working there fit with the church's mission. Recently, though, Sutton's noticed that as the affordable housing goes, so do many of the families she serves, and their new neighbors are less interested in getting involved.
It's been more of like, can you move? Can you leave? We want the neighborhood.
Directly across the street is record store owner Dan Balog. His shop is only about a year old, but he's been in the neighborhood for nearly a decade.
Now it's, you know, $700,000 homes where there used to be, you know, $70,000 homes in a pretty short amount of time.
Balog says he hasn't had much interaction with the church, but he's not surprised it's struggling to fit into the changing neighborhood. Even he feels the pressure as his rent keeps rising. He says if the church were replaced with a commercial business, it could bring him more foot traffic. And that might happen. In November, Sutton put the property up for sale, listing it for $3.5 million, seven times what the church bought it for in 2001.
And so our challenge is, where do we go?
The church will benefit from the infusion of capital, but that means leaving the neighborhood Sutton worked so hard to improve.
Before God says, the door to his church is open right now, is there one?
Back at First Baptist, Pastor Tipton has a very different idea about the future of his church. He wants to bring in new members, white members.
I want to be intentional about being a multiracial congregation without losing anybody's identity.
Longtime churchgoer Sam McCullough, whose family membership goes back seven generations, is confident the church's identity is solid.
We will always be a historically black congregation. That is what we are. You can't erase our history.
And so, despite going in two different directions, Tipton and Sutton have some common ground, a belief that something bigger is driving them, calling them, telling one to stay and the other to go. In Nashville, I'm Mara Benight for Marketplace.
So think about this for a second. A dollar bill is only worth something because we all believe it's worth something, right? Otherwise, it's just a piece of paper. A pretty piece of paper, though, if you are artistically inclined. Contemporary artist Mark Wagner uses deconstructed dollar bills as his chosen medium. We got him on the phone to talk about his collages and the like. Mark, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Kai.
Why money as a medium for you?
I'd been doing collage out of a whole bunch of different materials, and I wanted a piece of paper initially that was just super common, something that everyone could recognize. There's a power behind taking, you know, something that's familiar to everyone and making it into something completely new.
Yeah, and in some cases, just looking through your catalogs, you're not entirely recognizable. It takes you a second sometimes to go, oh, wait, that's money.
Yeah, at the shows, I find people pulling dollars out of their wallet a lot and sort of trying to match up pieces with things that they're familiar with.
Why? It's all single dollar bills, right? You're not into fives and tens and twenties?
It's maybe 95% single dollar bills at this point. I do mix some fives in and some tens, and then I use some foreign currency every once in a while. But it's the repetition that I can get from the one, and the fact that the one hasn't been redesigned. If you look at a $1 bill, it's got lots of nice, pretty parts on it, leaves and stuff that's been taken out of the fives and the tens.
The logical question that comes to mind is, boy, this must get expensive. You're cutting up money and using it that way?
You know, you would think so, but it's actually cheaper than a lot of other materials. Like oil paints are not cheap.
Yeah.
You know, a tube of cadmium red for, you know, for like a little 1 ounce tube will set you back like $20, $30.
Wow.
And I use almost all of the bill, and there's almost no overlap on the pieces. So, you know, even a big piece, even like a piece the size of a door, it might only be $250 on that.
There is something about money, right, that has an emotion to it. It has a spirituality is too much, but you know what I mean. What reaction do you get when people realize in galleries that it's money?
A bunch of different reactions, but primarily it's positive. Like, I think a lot of people sort of enjoy vicariously that I'm cutting up this thing that they themselves worry about, you know, that I worry about. I think there's certainly a taboo behind destroying money, even a taboo behind disrespecting it or wasting it. But I think a lot of people are kind of like happy to see it.
It's illegal, right? Isn't it? Isn't there a law that says you can't destroy American currency?
Yes, there is. And everybody brings that up, you know, like on anytime I see my stuff referred to online, there's always like a, you know, a roll call of nannies and hall monitors, you know, complaining about it being illegal.
Has the Secret Service come a calling yet?
No, they haven't. And actually I do have some work in the collection of the Federal Reserve.
Oh no, come on. Seriously? That's too meta.
Yeah, yeah. No. They have it. They've got currency collage in their collection. And a couple years ago, there was a portrait of Ben Bernanke that I did that was on display at the National Portrait Gallery in D.C. And I think that's only like two blocks from the FBI headquarters.
Mark Wagner is an artist that works primarily, I guess you'd say, in American currency. We'll put a link to some of his stuff on our website. It's marketplace.org. Mark, thanks very much.
Thanks, Kai. Thanks for having me.
Final note on the way out today, which pretty much bears out my business travel expense reporting anyway. According to the good people at Certify, that's an expense reporting company based out of Portland, Maine, Starbucks is the most expensed restaurant in the country. And yes, restaurant clearly is used as a flexible term here. But anyway, Starbucks accounts for just over 5% of all restaurant expense dollars, which is amazing. Average tab, what do you think, huh? $12.62. How about that? Large dark roast and one of those dark cherry yogurt things is what I get when I'm traveling, by the way. All right, so the Dow, the NASDAQ, and the S&P 500 all basically flat today. Theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitar Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager around these parts. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Have yourselves a great weekend, all right? This is APM.
Hey there, I'm Bridget, co-host of Million Bazillion, Marketplace's podcast for kids about money. I want to tell you about our email newsletter course, Million Bazillion Academy. In this new and improved course, we'll help your kids learn about crypto, credit cards, and inflation in just 6 weeks. Each lesson comes with a podcast episode, a fun cartoon, discussion questions, and an activity that lets kids apply what they're learning in the real world. You can start at any time and work at your own pace. Sign up today at marketplace.org/academy.